Hello and welcome to the first World This Week of 2025 with me, Gavin Lee. We are 10 days BT before Trump is back in office, and this week has seen the president-elect given an unconditional discharge, spared of jail or a fine, but confirmed as a convicted felon for fraud related to hush money payments to an adult film star. Meanwhile, he's making ever clearer his long-held desire to acquire Greenland, with his son and apparent envoy, Donald Jr., flying in on Trump Force One to the capital nuke. Expansion plans also appear to include the Panama Canal. The fact that neither are for sale seems a mere detail, and he says he wouldn't rule out military force to control them.
I can't assure you, you're talking about Panama and Greenland. No, I can't assure you on either of those two, but I can say this. We need them for economic security.
It's been a week where five US presidents gathered to say farewell to a sixth at the state funeral on a day of national mourning for Jimmy Carter at the Washington National Cathedral. A number of political enemies came together and appeared amiable as they said a formal farewell. Meanwhile, in France, news of the death of a controversial former far-right leader, Jean-Marie Le Pen, was received with tributes from the far-right, insults from the left, and a notably banal statement from the Prime Minister, François Bayrou.
Beyond the controversies that were his favorite weapon and the necessary confrontations on substance, Jean-Marie Le Pen was a huge figure of French political life. We knew, by fighting him, what a fighter he was.
And it's been a week which started with Hollywood stars on the red carpet at the kickoff to award season, the Golden Globes. Celebrations for celebrities one day, the next day saw them evacuating their homes as wildfires ravaged Los Angeles, ripping through the exclusive Pacific Palisades. Entire neighborhoods have been wiped out. Sunset Boulevard is in ruins.
Based on the devastation that is clear, it looks like a bomb, an atomic bomb dropped in these areas.
Welcome to the program. Joining me on the panel this week, we have Dave Clark, international correspondent for AFP News Agency. Dave, Happy New Year to you. First of all, any resolutions for 2025? Anything that's slipped already?
Plenty of things have slipped already, but I'm hoping to get back to Syria this year. I was there just before Christmas, and it's interesting what's happening there after such a long war.
Very interesting, given that you were there just after Christmas. And just before Christmas, it allows me to bring in Janine Giovanni here as well. Pleasure to have you with us. And this is something that you've had a career covering, well, many wars, many conflicts, author, journalists. Dave was talking about Syria. You wrote a book about your time in Syria. I want to know your thoughts on the end of last year, the tumultuous events of the fall of the Assad regime.
Just extraordinary. I was woken at about 5 in the morning by a Syrian friend who was in tears because while it was happening so quickly, it was extraordinary because what the Assads did over a 4-decade reign was cruelty that I have really rarely documented something like that. The torture, the enforced disappearances, the killing of children, mutilation, horrific. So, it is something joyful, jubilous, but also, as Dave will point out, we're waiting to see exactly what the political situation will be. Of concern for me, particularly because I focused a lot on Christians and minorities in Syria, is how will the Christians be protected? What will happen to the Alawites, of course? Will they be rehabilitated in some way? And also women. We don't want Syria to slide into a Taliban situation, Afghanistan again. But there's a lot to be done. And the most important thing for me, I think, is that the country will need to be rebuilt from every level, governance, physically. Aleppo had been, brutally destroyed, Homs, Hama. Accountability, justice, finding out about who were the exact perpetrators and going after them. But also, he is going to need donor money from other countries. So I don't know if you'll agree with me on this, but I think this is why he will stay away from having a kind of jihadist, Islamist tight mandate, because he's going to need international.
I was in Damascus, and it felt there that the new regime was planning to reach out and form some kind of a coalition. But then people who had traveled down with them from Idlib said things back there had were a lot tighter, more tightly run on an Islamist line. So we'll see what develops. He does seem to want the approval of the international community, though. Because one thing, you mentioned the Taliban. The Taliban obviously have not received any relief after they won, so they have not begun to rebuild their country. And I think Syria will need outside assistance.
I think he'll learn from that lesson.
It's both of you, we're going to bring in the other two panelists as well, but I do want to mention a time also to mention your project, the Reckoning Project. Yes. The idea of that is to teach conflict journalists how to record, how to collect, conserve information, testimony to be used usefully in a court of law. And I guess in Syria, this could also be very useful too.
Hugely. I mean, we're working in Ukraine right now, but we're expanding to Syria, Darfur, and other parts of the Middle East. And it's basically because journalists, as you know, our notebooks can be excellent, but it doesn't necessarily stand up in the court of law. So we work with local journalists to teach them how to identify war crimes, preserve them, take testimony, and then help build cases with the prosecutors at the ICC, the ICJ, and domestic courts.
Janine, great to have you with
Thank
us.
You.
Let's also bring in Tina Kirkensgaard, a correspondent for the Danish broadsheet online newspaper Politiken, and based here in Paris. Tina, great to have you with us. And I should ask about how your new year is going, but it's a new year in which Denmark has dominated headlines.
It's been very dramatic, yeah. I don't think anyone was counting on this to happen in Denmark. We're not used to playing such a big role in like the international sphere. But I think that our government is being calm about it. At least our prime minister is usually very firm and very strict in her communication, but this time she's been more hesitant and more diplomatic because she doesn't want to, of course, ruin the good relationship that we have with the US.
We're going to get onto that, the conundrum of dealing with Donald Trump, for Mette Frederiksen, for other governments in Panama as well, over Greenland, over Panama, and this sudden, well, this continued territorial expansion plan. Also, let's bring in, we have Paul Moreira, a regular friend of the programme, documentary maker, over many years and many conflicts. You're not a stranger to conflict zones either. Tell me about, your company's Premier Linea. What are you working on at the moment, or is it a secret?
Well, actually, I'm planning a trip to Syria also, to the Kurdish part of Syria, because the last time I was in Syria was in Raqqa. Filming the last battle of Raqqa in October 17. And I've been contacted by the SDF, as you know, the Syrian Democratic Forces, which is like front of the Kurdish forces that are secured kind of area called Rojava. And they're very, very afraid that the Turkish supported jihadi groups would wipe them out, really. And that could have consequences for all of us, since we know that the Kurds are controlling the camps, like Al Hol, with 75,000 people close to Daesh. So I'm preparing
maybe
a trip there.
And also this week, hearing from the Turkish foreign minister calling on the French to take some of them and to try them. And a diplomatic spat there. Great to have you with us, Paul, as well. Let's begin with extraordinary news on Friday, New York courthouse. The president-elect Donald Trump on video link awaiting his sentence, being convicted back in May, 34 counts relating to hush money payments to Stormy Daniels. And the sentencing, an unconditional discharge. No prison, no fine, no probation. The judge, Juan Marchand, wishing Donald Trump Godspeed, he said, at your second presidency at the end of the case, and said it was an extraordinary trial to judge. The next president of the US remains a convicted felon. There's reactions still coming into this after it's broke. But first of all, just want to get reactions from you. Janine, starting with your reading of this decision.
It's so embarrassing. I mean, when you really think about it, that a convicted felon is going to be leading not just the United States, but having a major role on the world stage. It's interesting to see from the time of the campaign, you know, how quickly people have shifted their alliance to suddenly line up to pay homage to him. That includes Mark Zuckerberg, who I'm sure we're going to discuss later, Jeff Bezos, all of the millionaires that basically fear him. And to me, I work on justice and accountability. My greatest fear isn't Syria or Gaza, although I'm terribly, terribly worried about Gaza. It's America. It's the erosion of democracy in America, which we already saw in 2016 to 2020 during his last reign. And what he will do now, he's already said he's vengeful. He's going to go after journalists. All right, journalists are his target, political opposition, but also taking on all of the proprietors of newspapers. And I think it's really important to remember that this is Vladimir Putin's playbook. So for whatever his MAGA people say, this is all about making America great again. To me, it's about making America as closely aligned to Russia, if not as allies, then certainly taking the playbook about how to destroy democracy. This is really scary, and we all should be incredibly vigilant about it.
We should be incredibly vigilant, Janine says, Dave. We heard from the judge today talking about this being an extraordinary case and saying it's very hard to compare another situation where you've got 34 convicted felon charges and yet to be allowed to walk free. Was it a surprise?
Well, no. The courts have already decided that he can do what he likes. The Supreme Court is apparently just as frightened of him as the media barons. He's won, and elections have consequences. He's not the only head of state in the world that enjoys impunity, apparently. There are arrest warrants have been issued in The Hague for Vladimir Putin, for Benjamin Netanyahu. We have a president, a former president here in France, who's just received a suspended sentence. The powerful people in this world do not suffer consequences for their actions, and that's something that we're going to have a reckoning over.
Which takes us on to when powerful people have powerful plans in mind. And let's talk about Greenland, because in Greenland there is a tradition in New Year with bonfires, fireworks, gathering to catch the spectacle of the northern lights. Perhaps that's why Don Jr. flew to Nuuk on Tuesday. He told the awaiting media he was just on holiday. Of course he was. Let's take a listen.
We're just here as tourists, looking at it.
So could you tell a little about the American interest in Greenland? There's been so
that's not for me to talk about. That's for others to talk about.
But, thank you, guys.
We're just excited to be here. Thank you, guys.
And others did talk about it. A coincidence that his dad, President-elect Trump, had repeatedly said and explicitly this week on social media and in his hour-long press conference at Mar-a-Lago that, quote, it is a deal that must happen for safety, security, strength and peace. Why does he want it? There is method in the madness, says Politico. Let's have a look at this article, if we can see it. Well, here we are. They're looking at the realities that they say aren't to do with imperialism, but actually more than that. It's about this hyper-global race between China and Russia and the US as the ice melts, resources appear. And, Tina, in the middle of it, you have Greenland, the autonomous island with judicial, military, defence control from Denmark, and the Danish government. Tell me about how the Danish government are reacting to this. What's Mette Frederiksen, the Prime Minister, saying?
Well, first of all, you cannot just buy Greenland. That is something that is very clear because it's an autonomous territory within the Danish Commonwealth. It's not something that you can just shop. And the Danish government is, of course, shocked. By the stuff that Trump has said about the not ruling out military or financial interference, but they're also quite calm about it. They're trying to say, well, if Greenland wants to be independent, first of all, it's up to the Greenlandic people. It's something that they decide, and. So actually, our prime minister has tried to keep a bit out of it and to say it's up to the Greenlandic people. If they want to be independent, they can be independent. But of course, being independent is not something that's going to happen tomorrow or this year or within the next 5 years. It's maybe probably a 10-year time period that we're looking into. And just before we started here, there was a press conference with the Danish prime minister and the Greenlandic government Yeah, in Danish it's called the Landsstyreformand. It's like the boss of
so
Greenland.
So the leader of Greenland.
The
of
leader of yes. Greenland, the government leader of yes. Greenland, with the two of them. And he said, the government leader of Greenland, Mutabi Il, he said that if we want to be independent, we're gonna activate that process. But it hasn't been activated yet. But we don't want to be either Danish or American. We want to be Greenlandic.
Is this useful for Greenlanders to have this debate going from the other side of the Atlantic to its own independence claims?
Well, yes, of course they can use that as a financial aid, to make new trade partners, because that's what they want. They don't want only to have, of course they don't have that now. They also have different trade partners as it is now, but it helps them in being more financially autonomous and also strategically autonomous. Mm-hmm. Because right now, as you started by saying that, right now it's still the military and foreign politics of Greenland is still being ruled by Copenhagen. Mm. So of course this helps Greenland in these independence dreams.
Okay, so there's something in it for Greenland. Paul, we're also hearing quite clearly about the Panama Canal and the rhetoric being that Donald Trump is worried about Chinese influence there. And yet, you know, we hear some pushback from EU leaders saying this: you can't just decide what you want and grab it when you can. What's your reading of this and whether there should be more reaction to it internationally?
There has always been this concept of restricted sovereignty from the neighboring countries of America. We all know in Central America in the 80s that the U.S. had been very, very active in shaping the politics of the region. The new thing is that Trump is the bully in the playground. It's just like, you know, let's annex Canada, let's annex the Greenland, let's annex the Panama Canal, and the man seems out of his mind. But I must say that there's a kind of continuity, even more grotesque than it has been until now. But really, it's not much different from what has been happening lately. Usually it's restricted to brown people speaking Spanish. The new thing is now that it's concerning also white people, and that's new.
And at the same time, Janine, a conflict that you've covered a lot and listened to rhetoric of President Putin over Ukraine, talking about the reasons, the justifications for extending Russia and the brotherhood of Ukrainian people, to flip that and look at how Beijing must be watching these developments with Trump's rhetoric right now. What do you make of that?
So the interesting thing about Trump is when he came out with that line, the future does not belong to globalists. So he hates globalists, but yet he's an expansionist. Mm. And what else is really interesting about him is he had this isolation policy. I mean, this is America. We need to focus on our own country, close the border to Mexicans. But now he's looking beyond. But it's all, I mean, as Politico said, it's a madman's foreign policy. And you're right. There is a consistency to what he does. I mean, the craziest thing about him is that it all kind of comes under this concept, which we learned as kids in American school, manifest destiny, the expansion of American territory. And one of the more terrifying things about the trip to Greenland was that a social influencer was brought along who was like a Donald J.'s bro. And he said, he came out with this quote, and I urge everyone to find it. I can't do it verbatim, but it was basically, we're going back to American male testosterone-fueled expansion. The energy is American. And as I read it, I had the chills because I thought, when have we heard? I mean, I always listen to rhetoric really carefully, what Putin says, what Netanyahu says, and how they say it, because it's so important about how it plays out onto policy. And I feel like if we listen to what Trump is saying now, we're getting a very clear agenda, a forecasting of what he may do.
Which takes us nicely, Janine, into concentrating on rhetoric, which you have to do nowadays. And you referred to it before from Mark Zuckerberg this week, because it was on Donald Trump's favourite TV station, Fox and Friends. This surprise announcement came on Tuesday. This recorded video message from Mark Zuckerberg, boss of Meta, the company that owns Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp. The site moderation is being changed. No more fact checkers being used in the US to fight disinformation, fake news. They are too politically biased, he said.
We're going to get rid of fact checkers and replace them with community notes similar to X, starting in the US. After Trump first got elected in 2016, the legacy media wrote nonstop about how misinformation was a threat to democracy. We tried in good faith to address those concerns without becoming the arbiters of truth. But the fact checkers have just been too politically biased and have destroyed more trust than they've created, especially in the US.
Well, he went on to say the recent elections feel like a cultural tipping point that is moving Meta's headquarters from Blue State, California to Red State, Texas, joining the likes of Elon Musk, Joe Rogan, Jeff Bezos' space company by setting up in a Lone Star State, as several critics put it, as courteous to King Trump ahead of his inauguration. Well, it was back in 2021, after the Capitol Hill riots, that Mark Zuckerberg removed President Trump from Facebook. In recent years, Trump has threatened Mark Zuckerberg with prospect of life imprisonment if he plotted against him. When reporters asked Trump directly this week if that was the reason for Meta's decision, he said probably yes. Dave Clark, what's your take?
Well, I have to be declare an interest. I work for Agence France-Presse, AFP, and we were one of the companies that was contracted to provide fact checks for Facebook until this announcement. So I'm possibly biased when I say this, but my company, along with others involved in an international fact-check alliance, which I gather is the body that the MAGA world has taken aim at, has released a statement on this and pointing out that Facebook never had any problem with the fact checks beforehand. Every year they've reviewed them, and they have said that they were doing the job and never mentioned this alleged bias, which has now surfaced. And also in his statement, Facebook announcing something on Fox News, it's like this whole audience is for the over 70s, but the statement that he made, he also accused the fact checkers of censorship, whereas in fact the fact checks were provided to Facebook and they decided what posts to take down on the basis of them. The fact checkers themselves had no authority to take down anything. So any censorship that did take place prior to this announcement was carried out by Mr. Zuckerberg's company, which is, I imagine, why Trump and people around him have been threatening Zuckerberg all this time. It's interesting as a European observer to see that the giants of free enterprise and libertarianism in the States are terrified of government and will fall into line as soon as government threatens them.
We had Chris Morris on recently, the CEO of Full Fact website, a former colleague of mine at the BBC, who said it is a huge disappointment, not just for his company, which was and still provides fact-checking in Europe, because it's just the US arm.
But we still do in Europe as well.
This is that's my question to you. So AFP, they still have a European, they're still running for...
But the fact-checks that we carried out on stories that emanated from the United States were carried out in the United States under contract to Facebook. So things that you will see on your Facebook if you are based in Europe, if they began in the United States, will not be moderated at this point.
Paul, Mark Zuckerberg's point is that this is about free speech. Critics say this is a craven way to show sucker to Donald Trump. Your thoughts?
Obviously, I mean, in French, we have a saying, on prête de corriche, we only lend to rich people. And obviously, power attracts power. But maybe there's an economical side of it. Like, I just months before, I did something about with an NGO in Asia fighting against the trade of tiger byproducts. And they said that those byproducts were sold mostly on Facebook. So they had implemented some talks with Facebook, you know, help us, because 85% of what's happening is happening on your site. And they said, we start talking with them, and they were very open. And all of a sudden, they laid off 11,000 people. And there was no check on what was sold, and it's actually criminal products that are sold on Facebook. So there may be something that we don't see, but like an opportunity for Mark Zuckerberg to get rid of certainly a huge amount of people doing the fact-checking for them.
Well, it's a good point, Janine, getting rid of a huge amount of people. I think there are estimations around $5.5 billion would be saved on the whole fact-checking system, the protection operation in place. And yet, we're going to see a community notes operation in place. What do you make of X's community notes?
I mean, I want to get back to one point, though, about Zuckerberg, which is just really shocking for me. He's the third richest man in the world. His Meta has following of 3 billion people globally. Why did he back down to Trump? Yeah. Why is he kissing the ring? I feel, not that I ever was a fan of Mark Zuckerberg's, but I feel that this caving in, like these billionaires lining up one by one by one in fear of Trump and basically handing him on a silver platter social media. Now, we can all say we're going to go off Facebook or we're not going to use Threads or Instagram. But the fact is, it is a massive influence, massive. So there will be more political content, as we know. The Republicans had long complained that that Zuckerberg was biased against them. But now they will be able to do whatever they want. So you asked about X. Basically, I mean, most people I know are gone off X. We still check it, but we're on Blue Sky, which seems like it will probably have its own problems down the road. But, you know, I think increasingly with Musk having such a prevalent role in the U.S. government, we're getting back again to Putin-type territory with there's no line between the government and the media.
Which takes us on to arguably the influencer of all influencers right now, Elon Musk, as you say, engaging in online warfare with the British government this week, attacking Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, on a daily basis, tweeting on X unfounded claims that the Prime Minister is, quote, hiding terrible things in connection with a grooming gang scandal from more than 10 years ago, in which a group of predominantly Pakistani men were found guilty of the horrific sexual abuse of young white girls in Rotherham, Oldham, Telford, Oxford. A very complicated case, questions about why more wasn't done about consecutive governments, anger that the victims' claims just were not taken seriously. Keir Starmer was director of public prosecutions at the time of these cases coming to light, and yet evidence shows he acted to help victims, help change the law to prosecute cases. This is Andrew Norfolk. He's the Times journalist who uncovered the story, spent 4.5 years on it. And he said he was speaking out because Elon Musk, he said, could not be further from the truth. This is what he said this week, in his words, to set the record straight.
Keir Starmer, I sat with him and Nazarasa. We talked through this. He completely changed the rules. His decision led to a massive increase in the number of successful prosecutions across the country. For all the easy, cheap nonsense that's been peddled these last few days, significant changes were made. And for all the hatred of the mainstream media that is being so cheaply, easily thrown about, it was the mainstream media that kept writing about this until eventually Rotherham Council was shamed into ordering the independent inquiry by Alexis J, which in 2015 finally produced the extraordinary finding that 1,500 girls in Rotherham had been brutally abused, and that almost all of the identified offenders were from the Pakistani community. Rotherham's Pakistani population was less than 4% of Rotherham's, almost all identified perpetrators. And to this day, the most frustrating thing for me is that nobody has done the official research to understand why.
Andrew Norfolk, who spent 4.5 years to a point where he told his bosses at the time he couldn't work on this anymore, it was physically killing him, the amount of detail, it was horrendous to see. But it's important, I would recommend listening to the whole interview that he says, fact-checking Elon Musk on that. And Elon Musk is promoting the far right in Britain and in Germany too. European leaders are fighting back, but like the Scottish play, to a Shakespearean accent, they won't say his name. Both Keir Starmer and President Macron this week warning against lies, disinformation and political interference. Dave, is Elon Musk the new Rupert Murdoch, only no longer behind the curtain, well in front of it?
Well, Rupert Murdoch employed Andrew Norfolk at the Times, and was so it's a little bit unfair to compare the two. Not that I'd make a habit of defending Rupert Murdoch, but in this case, he's not the main villain. It has been an extraordinary series of attacks on European leaders and on the British Labour-led government from Elon Musk in recent days. Obviously, a lot of it is just internet conspiracy theory that he's recycling. Now, a lot of the commentary in Europe has complained that, oh, he doesn't understand German politics, doesn't understand British politics. So my concern is that he understands it as well as anybody, and that this is who he is. He is a far-right conspiracy merchant. And you mentioned that he's been attacking Keir Starmer daily, and we've been reading about it daily. He's been attacking Keir Starmer hourly. It's not clear to me when he sleeps. I'm never quite sure what time zone he's in, but he's tweeting all day, or Xing, or whatever we call it now. And now that he has diplomatic cover by effectively being an aide to the incoming US president, European leaders are a bit at a loss about how to respond to him. And I've been a little bit disappointed, frankly, in Brussels. And I used to work there in the European Commission, along with the EU member states and the EU Parliament, passed a couple of major laws about regulating the internet, the Digital Services Act and the DMA, the Digital Media Act, Management Act, I don't know, the DSA and the DMA. And we spent a lot of time talking about them. And it was a big part of the stories we did. And this was going to be, you know, Europe, the regulatory superpower that was going to bring Silicon Valley to heel. And there's not been a single action taken under these new laws yet. X has been under investigation for months now. And the internet has not got better, is my cautious analysis of the result of these two laws.
Or to misquote a Danish Borgen slogan in Brussels, nobody can hear you scream. It's the fact that nobody is screaming right now in Brussels, Tina. When you're looking at this, Dave just pointed to it then, you know, what does he want? What is Elon Musk's agenda? How does he find the time to sleep? He's said to be an incredibly intelligent man, well-read man. He's in charge of many companies, clearly the richest man in the world. What's your take on what could be behind it?
Well, that's
a million-dollar question.
That's a million-dollar question, I must admit. I think that, I don't think anybody understands what's going on in the mind of Elon Musk. I know that there's been written like reports and books about him and his childhood, and maybe there is a lot of, I don't know, diagnosis that we don't know of, and that we some that we do know of. But I also think that, of course, there is this that is evident to all of us that he's also against this, like, politically correctness, as Zuckerberg is also talking about, that there's been a political bias in the public sphere. Like, it seems, I don't know why he decided to go into this battle. Why is it's like Musk's, it's like a value, it's a debate on values that we've seen that Trump started with the MAGA movement against political correctness, as they say in the US. And for some reason, Musk wants to continue that and also wants to have influence of that in Europe. Mm-hmm. So of course it's very dangerous. It's something that we have to take very seriously. But we also have to look at what are actually the consequences? What have the consequences been so far regarding to how, like, the control of the media, control of the social media, have they, in fact, had a big consequence effect on elections, for example? That's not something that has been concluded specifically. So we also have to be critical about what impact is this actually going to play, because we also have to believe that we educate our own people to be critical of these messages that Musk comes. Yeah.
As Tina said, Ginny, if we listen to, as Dave said as well, the itchy trigger fingers of Elon Musk tweeting, Xing all the time, his argument being, you see it streamed by the algorithm, that other media bosses do this, he just does it more openly.
Mm. I think what is really important is to, and you touched on this, the influence of social media, that it has the impact on policy. And in Ukraine, my team, The Reckoning Project, we look very carefully at how tweets or X's, whatever they're called. Now, what happens on the ground in Ukraine, say 24 or 48 hours before the tweet goes out, and then what happens after? The case of Bucha, the massacre in the village of the town of Bucha outside of Kyiv in 2022. If you look at the patterns of the tweets, the X's that went out 2-3 days before it, very, very influential in terms of the behavior of the soldiers on the ground. And Facebook, the Myanmar case, I mean, there was really clear distinction that there was incitement of the police, the Myanmar police, inciting towards a genocide. So, I mean, I think aside from these billionaires being completely unregulated and being allowed to influence media in this way, there's a bigger question of how they control the world.
Yes, there's a ripple effect of every single tweet Facebook post.
On a kind of micro level, we have this horror with teenage girls, and there's been a lot said this week with Zuckerberg's decision about how this will affect teenagers, who are, of course, very engaged with Instagram and Threads. But also, for me, I look at how it's going to affect war criminals and how it will give license to criminals to act with more and more impunity. So, I mean, that's really my big concern. And I feel like the closer we get to Trump getting into office, what I said earlier, the more vigilant we have to be about how he is taking away democracy and the ripple it will have everywhere, not just America.
Paul, I want to bring in you at this point as well, because on the subjects that Ginny was talking about of free speech and the issues and the ripple effects, it was 10 years that the masked gunman burst into the offices of Charlie Hebdo, the irreverent satirical newspaper where 12 people were assassinated, the attackers claiming allegiance to Al-Qaeda. It was a decade on. This week, President Macron leading tributes at the site of the attack, the paper's former headquarters, and the paper's editor, known as Rees, a survivor, gave an interview this week to The Economist and said its irreverence towards all religions remains the same, but now it operates in an undisclosed location. Rees lives under a fatwa and police protection, but he said nothing has quite been the same since, but they will carry on, unbowed, true to form every week, publishing a paper that's just as tasteless, provocative as before. Paul, I mention you because you were there that day, you witnessed the aftermath. Tell me about your reflections this week.
Well, yeah, our offices were right next door to Charlie Hebdo, so we were the first ones, our team were the first ones to enter Charlie Hebdo's room with all the people who were killed and wounded, and we took away the survivors that were in. You can imagine the shock they were in, and that's something that really affected us, even though we were not the target of the attack. But an attack of this dimension really impregnates the mind of people who are witness or even collateral victims, because basically that's what we were. I think that one of the things that was very healing on the aftermath of the attack was the fact that there was this huge demonstration that showed that France was not shaken on the core of its values of tolerance and universalism and openness to the other, because basically there was the agenda of the attackers was to polarize and to instill conflict between us, and that didn't work out. Nevertheless, that said, we are in a state where racist ideas have progressed in this country, and we are more polarized than we were 10 years ago. And even though there are strong foundations in France resisting the temptation of racism and exclusion of the others, we can see that this tendency is steadily growing, and it's very concerning. And that it doesn't seem to stop.
No. Paul, thank you. And notable as well, there's a poll recently, quite depressing, that suggested the support for the spirit of Charlie Hebdo a couple of years ago was around 58% French people, compared to 2016 on 78%. So particularly depressing that that seems to have ebbed away. This moves us on in the time we have left to what happened on Monday morning in Ottawa. A 10:45 it was, newsrooms around the world watching the lectern outside Rideau Cottage, the official residence of the Canadian Prime Minister. A big announcement, long rumoured, finally confirmed by Justin Trudeau.
I intend to resign as party leader, as Prime Minister, after the party selects its next leader through a robust, nationwide, competitive process. Last night, I asked the President of the Liberal Party to begin that process. This country deserves a real choice in the next election, and it has become clear to me that if I'm having to fight internal battles, I cannot be the best option in that election.
So Justin Trudeau gone ahead of upcoming elections. Parliament prorogued for the next few weeks while a new Liberal leader is chosen. But it's the Conservatives, anti-woke populist leader Pierre Poilievre, that's polling as the favourite. They're calling him Canada's Donald Trump, unfairly or not. Well, here he is talking to the right-wing psychologist turned podcast host Jordan Peterson in an hour-long interview this week and asked what was wrong with Trudeau. What happened?
We have a prime minister who is dedicated to a extremely radical ideology. It is just a rehashed socialism that has been discredited again and again and again throughout the ages. And his basically authoritarian socialism has guided him throughout his entire prime ministership. He believes in a state that controls every aspect of your life.
Janine.
Yeah.
So 10 years ago, there were issues that he came in on a landslide, things like climate change, equality, indigenous rights. Those things seem to have moved out of the picture now about housing, employment, immigration. What's your take on the end of Trudeau?
It's almost as though the public is losing faith in liberalism. We saw it in America. You know, the Democrats now are basically thought of as being not just corrupt, but having done a terrible job for 4 years. And we see it in Canada. I think Trudeau came in with the notions that his father had, basically that Canada, his father, Pierre, of course, who was 70s, very, very popular Prime Minister of Canada, that Canada was a multinational, multilingual country that was looking to a social welfare state of the best kind. And I think Justin succeeded. He legalized marijuana. He had carbon. Taxing. But now, I think post-pandemic, the same as in America, the sluggish economy just killed him. That and incidents, the terrible trip to India.
Yep. The blackface, you know, row.
The brown face, black face several times, and also his going to a private island of the Aga Khan. So all these added up, and basically he was in power for 9 years. He had a good run. Interesting to look at Chrystia Friedlander, our former colleague.
Who speaks fluent Ukrainian.
Her mother was Ukrainian. She grew up speaking Ukrainian. She worked for many years in Ukraine when she was a student at Harvard, basically going after the KGB courageously. So my money is on her, that she will take over from Poilievre. And it would be an important win for liberalism.
Very interesting. Paul, a final word in the brief time we have, 30 seconds or so. Very interesting on Chrystia Freeland. Worth saying Trudeau is a big friend of Emmanuel Macron. Do you see any parallels there?
You know, on higher level, the problem now is that liberals tend to be associated with elite and conservative, with anarcho-capitalist agendas, which is crazy, tend to be associated with populism, you know, with defending the masses. So we are in an ideological twist now that anything can happen because we're seeing things the other way around. You know? And that's the danger for all the liberal leaders on this planet now, and this huge push of anarcho-capitalism, authoritarianism, is directly linked to that. So
in a Lewis Carroll world. Great to have you all. Thank you, Paul Moreira, co-director of Premier Linde Productions, Janine DiGiovanni, a founder of The Reckoning Project, Dave Clark, international correspondent at AFP, and Tina Kirkensgaard from the Danish newspaper Politiken. Thank you for watching. We'll leave you with, well, fairly rare farewell from five presidents, the state funeral of the 39th president, Jimmy Carter. We'll see you in 7 days for The World Next Week.